Now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our second speaker, keynote speaker, Andreas Mazari, who is a Palestinian but based in British Columbia in Canada, teaches at the University of British Columbia in comparative education. Andreas Mazari needs no introduction, like Ronald, to the comparative education scene. And he's associate member of the Center for Policy Studies in Higher Education and Training at UBC, University of British Columbia. You know, this is the North American fascination for acronyms. It's a lovely university, actually, a lovely campus in a lovely city. And he serves as associate editor of the Canadian Journal of Higher Education. Higher education is one of his areas of expertise. He authored recently Knowledge Society or Worker Spectacle. It's actually a question. Knowledge Society or Worker Spectacle. Education for Work and the Prospects of Social Transformation in Arab Societies. And he's one of the foremost comparativists with regard to also the Arab world. So when we talk about, when we have a problem about the Arab world, Ronald tells me we have to contact Andreas about it, for the, you know, to get his insights on this. And he's also published in a book edited by Farrell and Fenwick, right? Or Fenwick, as they would say, across the Atlantic, published by London and Routledge. So there's a series of papers which you can find on the website where you've got the whole profile. So it's my pleasure to introduce Andreas to give us his talk, which is entitled Wither an Arab Knowledge Society, Regionalism, Nation State, and Educational Research for Development.
Okay, good morning to everybody, and it was quite a surprise to be projected into the first session. But actually, after hearing Professor Sultana, actually, I'm happy that this change has taken place, as several of the things that he has talked about actually would resonate and actually make my task a little bit difficult to put things in the same articulate fashion that he has done this morning. But I would like to start my talk today, this morning, first of all by thanking very much the organizers of this conference, and by thanking Professor Sultana also for kindly, through the Euromed Center for Education Research, initiating my invitation to this university. And it's a great pleasure to be able to share with you this morning this conference and the themes that it is bringing forward. So thanks to the organizers and to Professor Sultana for this opportunity. My own research, actually, as Professor Mayo has just indicated, has shifted over the last decade. As a Palestinian who grew up in Israel, I started my journey rather by focusing on very particular issues regarding the education of the Palestinian society within Israel as a subjugated politically and minority, political and economically. And it has been only later on in my encounter with colleagues, scholars and peers from across the Arab region that I started to realize what I think Professor Sultana has been referring to as that particular which becomes of larger importance, to see some intersections between processes of oppression, repression, and the role that education plays in that regard. And later on, I became much more concerned about a very particular issue that I would like to focus on today in my talk, which pertains to the way education and knowledge are positioned in relation to each other. And this is a topic and a theme that Ronald picked on this morning. And particularly as the discourses on the knowledge society, are becoming increasingly more prevalent within broader calls for educational reforms in the Arab, across the Arab region, and one could say even beyond that. So I don't see my talk as being limited and constrained to the Arab region, and probably some of the things that I would be talking about may resonate with other calls for reform in relation to that knowledge society that you may encounter in other regions, but I would like to focus on that aspect. So I'm going to read it, given that it's an argument that I'm going to put forward. Calls to build a knowledge society are a key feature of current discourses on development. The notion of a knowledge society has wide-ranging ramifications for educational policy making, school administration, and the reculturing of the professional worldview of educators. Andy Hargrave, he's a Canadian scholar, observes that, quote, more and more governments, businesses, and educators are urging teachers in the knowledge society to commit themselves to standard-based learning, in which all students, not just a few, achieve high standards and cognitive learning, end quote. This rationale is driven by a focus on student achievement as an indicator of skills and human capital formation in a competitive global economy. Critics have argued that the narrow focus on student achievement neglects the fostering of what he calls a greater sense of community and citizenship as educational ends worthy of pursuit. Given this framework, if so, then educational reforms that seek to build a knowledge society, and I use it in brackets, cannot be detached from the larger societal, political, and economic context. It is therefore imperative to explore how particular notions of the knowledge society are becoming discursively constructed and how they frame educational reforms. Such an exploration would allow us to better understand, as Monkman and Bird have noted, how agendas become hegemonic through international, global, and supranational discourses among the myriad of actors and organizations that are involved in development and education. In this presentation, I propose to explore the nexus between discourses on the knowledge society and discourses on educational reform. I dwell more particularly on the case of the Arab region, broadly defined, and we would not problematize that term today. My aim is to clarify how competing development agendas are politically constructed and why educational development has become such a contentious and contested terrain in the Arab region. My presentation proceeds in three movements, if you want, or in three parts, whose convergence, hopefully, articulates the argument I wish to make. I start first by outlining the contradictory discourses which underpin the notion of a knowledge society, and I do believe this is a notion that is so widely used that few people don't have the opportunity to think about it a little bit. So I would like to outline these contradictory discourses, their institutional origins, and their political articulations within the Arab region. I then move in the second part to show how calls to build an Arab knowledge society inform and frame educational reforms. In this second part, I would argue that educational reforms in the Arab region have become deeply enmeshed with political discourses that subjugate visions of the knowledge society, however defined, to agendas concerned with the combating of political militant movements. All this under the guise of development. Finally, in the third part, which partly Professor Sultana touched on, I interrogate the role of educational research and the role it plays in articulating a viable notion of development in the Arab region. So I start by positioning these discourses on the knowledge society. And I start by referring to some of the major publications that have appeared on the international scene lately. The authors of a UNESCO report released in 2005 and entitled Towards Knowledge Societies, state that a reflection upon knowledge society and how to build them makes it possible to rethink development itself. That's a very dramatic statement. They further observe, these authors, that, quote, knowledge societies are about capabilities to identify, produce, process, transform, disseminate, and use information to build and apply knowledge for human development. They require an empowering social vision that encompasses plurality, inclusion, solidarity, and participation, end quote. Another UN report, sponsored by the Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, articulates the contribution of a knowledge society to development in the following way. A knowledge society, they say, leads to citizens who are more creative, gender balanced, adaptable, and skilled. Learning and and developing new skills and abilities not only leads to economic growth and prosperity, but also supports wider social objectives of inclusion and equality. Investment in people and skills does not only bring benefits to children and young people, but also the creation of new skills that give rise to new jobs, new technologies, and new industries. So knowledge, broadly defined, knowledge in itself becomes, without defining what it is, becomes almost the magic solution for everything. It becomes the basis, the foundation of whatever it is for development. Central to this vision of the knowledge society is the construction of education as a subset of wider economic policy. According to Michael Peters and Tina Wilsey, the knowledge society operates as a policy tool through which the relationship of education and work is reconfigured around the processing of intangible capital. Within this context, Philip Brown and Hugh Lauder observed that, and it is an interesting quote, schools, colleges, universities, think tanks, design centers, and research labs are now on the front line in the search for competitive advantage between countries, end quote. All these institutions are called upon to facilitate what they call the mobilization of the people to the common educational cause, as in a conscription which asserts that there is no other source of individual, family, or national welfare than this. A knowledge society is also perceived by its proponents as facilitating the democratization of developing countries through the creation of public spaces, social and economic, where ideas are debated, freely exchanged, and disseminated. Kind of end-of-times vision. Calls to build more particularly an Arab knowledge society have indiscriminately extended this framework, the framework I briefly outlined above, to the Arab region. Most notably, along the last decade, a team of Arab scholars and activists associated with the UN-sponsored Arab Human Development Report emphasized the need for Arab societies to embark on what they call a cognitive journey. This is a quote from the report, and which is presented as the only way to lead the region into a renaissance. They identify knowledge, quote, as the road to development and liberation, especially in a world of intensive globalization. They call for the building of a knowledge society as a cornerstone of human development, a means to expanding people's capabilities and choices, and a tool for overcoming human poverty, end quote. Policies in this direction have also been consistently promoted by international, non-governmental, and semi-governmental organizations involved in setting up the development agenda across the Arab region. Western governments and political blocs like the US and the European Union, which were mentioned previously, are equally involved in shaping current policies concerned with the building of this knowledge society across the Arab region. This is evident, for example, in the announcement of the U.S. Middle East Partnership Initiative and the U.S. Greater Middle East Initiative publicized in 2002 and 2004 respectively, and which call for the building of a knowledge society through literacy corps, the wiring of schools to the internet, the introduction of discovery schools, and the bridging of educational deficits. Calls to build an Arab knowledge society, however, are oblivious to the culturally seated articulations of knowledge. Their complexity and their embeddedness within historically and socially situated forms of social and political organization. While various ideological and political currents in the Arab region, be they Islamic, nationalist, Marxist, leftist, liberal culturalist, whatever, uphold the role of knowledge in society in terms of its transformative power. However, they differ on its political and social articulations. In this sense, discourses on knowledge and what knowledge represents and its roles in society are subject to significant, often vehement controversies, themselves grounded in distinct perceptions of the state, of community, and of notions of development and political participation. Over this backdrop, critics of this agenda of the knowledge society have counter-argued that calls to build an Arab knowledge society cannot be dissociated from the broader unequal power relations associated with Western colonialism and imperialism, and which continue to affect Arab and Muslim societies in many different ways. These critics maintain that knowledge should be understood not as a marketable product, but as a socially constructed, culturally immersed, and as a historically situated phenomenon. Then they therefore argue that clarifying the intersection of power and knowledge is pivotal if Arab societies are to build a viable platform of social transformation, one which transcends hegemony and economic subordination through education. And this view has been expressed by many scholars across the region, one of whom, for example, just for illustration, from Algeria, was writing that the knowledge society model, as I articulated it before, is seen as a disruptive policy tool deployed to alter what he perceived the components of Arab and Islamic culture and identity. For him, this version of the knowledge society seeks to organize the markets in favor of transnational corporations, completely disregarding a genuine economic development of the Arab countries, their industrialization and agriculture, while providing priority to the freeing of trade and the limiting of the role of the state. This particular version of the knowledge society, he says, deepens the dependency of the Arab region on Western capitalist economies. Not only does it fail, this notion of the knowledge society, to offer a platform for national liberation and emancipation, but it maintains, according to this view, the economic marginality of Arab societies. In this sense, critics point out that the current notion of the knowledge society and how it is articulated in relation to education reflects a neoliberal foundation or a neoliberal articulation of the knowledge society propagated, for example, through this Arab Human Development Report. And, for example, some of the critics, Chaudhry, she is a scholar from UCLA, for instance, has argued that the model of this knowledge society has its roots in the Washington Consensus and represents a version of neoliberalism described as a genesis model of development in which economic growth is assumed to be the causal result of democracy, a causal link she refutes or dismisses. Her conclusion resonates with Asif Bayat's critique of the Arab Human Development Report. And he says, I quote, who is based on liberal perceptions of the state as if it was a neutral apparatus representing public interest. In that sense, Bayat questions the usefulness of the notion of a knowledge society as a tool for development. For him, a knowledge society is an outcome not of planning, but of highly developed market forces in post-industrial societies. So in this first part, what I try to do is to introduce the complexities of the notion of the knowledge society. Given the simplicity, sometimes very naive, I suppose, that links knowledge society and development through education, calling on us to effect radical changes in education, introduce reforms, when the links between knowledge, however defined, and education are so poorly defined. As I tried also to articulate in this first part, we cannot disregard the intersection between the understanding of a knowledge society and the broader regional, geopolitical, and global political and economic flows and interdependencies. In the second part, now I move to a little bit discuss how this notion of the knowledge society has impacted or has shaped or informed calls to effect educational reforms in the Arab region. Calls to build an Arab knowledge society have mounted an all-front critique of what they label as the deficiencies of Arab school and higher education systems. For instance, Nader Fergani, the lead author of the Arab Human Development Report, states in an independent piece that, quote, the knowledge acquisition system of Arab countries is fragmented, weak, and poorly productive compared to other countries and world regions. Another, a UNDP official, Najat Rushdie, for example, claims that if an Arab knowledge society is to become reality, then Arab education, quote, will have to be completely remodeled if we are to succeed in educating citizens for the year 2020 and not citizens with their heads buried in past decades, end quote. Abdul Razzaq bin Habib and Tahir Ziani, for instance, posit that, quote, the problem of deteriorating human capabilities assumes tragic proportions in the case of training available, to the young generations engaged in research and development in the Arab countries, severely restricted, out of date, and of poor quality, and so forth. So the interface between education reforms and the broader labor market and economy are being really restructured given this vision of the knowledge society. Often, for some of the countries, if it is Egypt or other countries in the Maghreb area, by IMF and World Bank restructuring packages. But this the interface between education reforms and the broader labor market and economy, however, are being differentially structured across the Arab region in ways which, as I would argue now, further fragment the Arab region into yet more dependent sub-regions through educational development. The Maghreb countries, for instance, Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria, are more directly impacted by the free trade agreements and schemes of cooperation drawn with the European Union as part of the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership. At the same time, Gulf Cooperation Council member states in the Arabian Peninsula are drawn more closely into the orbit of American educational policy making through the active involvement of think tanks, foreign diplomacy, and imported consultants. These special processes institutionalize highly differentiated knowledge regimes in different parts of the Arab region, regimes which are more strongly linked vertically to competing extra-regional economic and political centers of power than horizontally among the Arab regions. According to Kevorkian and Lasha, this sub-regionalization deepens the dependency of the Arab region on technologies imported into the Arab region as part of a free trade agreement as consumer-ready packages under the banner of promoting a knowledge society. Mark Warshauer, a researcher that has been also involved in some of the development work in Egypt, shows, for instance, with regard to Egypt, that the introduction of information and communication technology in education is not only a top-down policy process devoid of genuine public participation, but it also replicates rituals of educational reforms, largely disconnected from the very aim advocated or very aims advocated by the Ministry of Education in a guise of a frenetic purchase, consumption, and incorporation of technologies which contribute little to transform learning and teaching practices, or still even that do not contribute to widen educational opportunities for students. Rather, and this is where I now shift to another type of research, rather a strategic motive of international development packages provided, for example, to Egypt, reflects, according to Fatma Sayed, quote, a desire to contain militant Islamist fundamentalist movements perceived as a major strategic threat to the interests of the West in the area. Sayed further observes that education is identified by many donors and development agencies, quote, as a crucial agent of internal and regional political stability, end quote. The government and international development agencies therefore allocate, quote, significant resources and activities to contain the phenomenon of militant fundamentalism as a present and urgent threat to internal political and economic stability, end quote. And this is an interesting shift. What I'm trying to say here is that actually you can see how notions of developing a knowledge society, notions of development in relation to the knowledge society, are actually framed and subjugated to broader considerations of a political and geopolitical order. It also bears noting that at the same time that the UN and other international organizations emphasize the importance of the knowledge society as a vehicle of development in the Arab region, extensive damage to development continue to be inflicted precisely by UN sanctions on some countries, but also by civil war, military conflicts, and economic blockades. These have hampered the educational and economic infrastructure of several Arab states at different points in time and to various degrees. For instance, with regard to Iraq, Veloso de Saint-Estevan states that the sanctions imposed by the UN Security Council between 1990 and 2003, quote, were the most severe and the most prolonged ever to have been imposed on a country, end quote, leading to, and I quote again, an unparalleled educational catastrophe and to a steep rise in child mortality and malnutrition. He observes that sanctions and the resulting occupation of Iraq, quote, inhibit the reconstruction of the education system, and that there is sufficient information currently available to argue that the sanctions policies not only reversed previous educational achievements, but rendered the Iraqi education system unable to serve the population. Santi Stiban concludes his review of UN, UNESCO, and other official reports published over more than a decade by noting that, quote, the education system, indeed the whole country, has been de-developed through 13 years of sanctions. And that's an interesting point, I think, because when one looks at all these documents on the knowledge society and the link to development produced by UN agencies, UN international aid agencies, at the same time these agencies are deeply involved in the politics of the same region that they say they want to develop. But often there is a complete disconnect in researchers' minds about the fact that these documents are actually operating within the same institutional platforms. Iraq is not only the only case in point. The political, military, and population displacements that have taken place over the last decades through North Africa, the Middle East, notably in the occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza Strip, and the current blockade on Gaza, for instance, and the Arabian Peninsula, illustrate the immense difficulty and challenge to even talk about the emergence of the knowledge society in the Arab region, and the immense difficulty to talk about any meaningful restructuring of education outside the frame of global politics and the regional geopolitical manifestations. The latter continue to shape the effectiveness, viability, and scope of many education reforms as of other development policies in general. In the aftermath of September 11, 2001, debates on the role of education in building a knowledge society and promoting development through education have become even more shadowed by policies which are, in the word of Amr Hamzawi, framed in the context of combating terrorism. Editorials, for instance, published in The Economist, illustrate this logic and the way it operates. Editorials published shortly after Iraq's invasion in early 2003 and in 2004 expressed frustration over the failure to translate the American military intervention in Iraq, quote, into support for the American agenda of privatization, opening the door of foreign investment, de-Islamized education, and women's rights, end quote. Another editorial published in The Economist several months later complains about widespread resistance across the Arab region to the perceived onslaught of Americanization. Elsewhere, curricular reforms are perceived, for instance, by T. Morgan in the Times Educational Supplement, as education is perceived as a policy tool, quote, to help eradicate Islamic extremism, in his words. Dorothy Harnish, another consultant work in the Gulf, considers the roles of education in development as the best insurance against terrorism. A RAND publication frames education as a critical battlefield in which, quote, the future of political Islam will be decided in the schools. Within this broader context, regional geopolitics and global relations of power have directly and literally percolated into the classroom, into the textbooks, into teacher education program, and into school restructuring plans. I'm not saying that there is no need for such reform. But when you have this conflation of discourses, then anything you do is going by definition to trigger yet more resistance. These discourses fuel controversies over the aims of the school reforms, rendering a viable notion of development through education less likely to emerge and more difficult to translate into an effective longer-term reform. More particularly, the subtext of development discourses that I outlined earlier is that education reforms operate primarily as tools of containment or surveillance of political and civic dissent and as facilitators of national and regional political stability. So this fact of maintaining regimes becomes actually the discourse on development. This subtext emphasizes the need to depoliticize educational content by highlighting their contribution to the students' acquisition of globally competitive skills and knowledge. More often than not, such efforts have promoted a pedagogy whose epistemic culture reflects the knowledge, in brackets, concerns and value priorities dictated by donor countries and organizations, resulting in the disqualification of local and regional groups, communities, and movements. This trend vindicates Janjala Tilak's observation, quote, that the knowledge base accumulated in many of these societies over long periods is rarely recognized. In fact, there is an outright disregard for locally based knowledge. I move now to the third part and the final part, if you bear with me, of my presentation this morning, where I would like to talk about the role education research has played within this broader agenda. I would start by saying that there is an absolute disjuncture between education research and development through education within the framework that I have outlined above. And most of the research, I don't have enough time to go through this, most of the policy-based research, policy-oriented research, lacks minimal empirical and methodological sophistication and is usually driven within this broader agenda that I have been outlining above. The disjunction between the building of a knowledge society, education reforms, and development in the Arab region is particularly manifest in the field of education research. In a book published in Arabic and entitled Fear of the Question and the Crisis of Arab Educational Thought, Nakhle Wahbe laments the disconnect that exists between educational thought and practice in Arab societies. In an earlier book, Wahbe decries the ritualized approach that plagues educational research in the Arab region. He observes that researchers emulate techniques deemed to represent valid research, applying them thoughtlessly. Wahbe more generally laments this ossification, which ends up generating hegemonic discourses paraded as research, preventing educators and policymakers from contemplating creative and transformative alternatives. He argues that knowledge is indiscriminately important and haphazardly assembled to provide a semblance of school systems that work, regardless of the context in which such knowledge is produced or of its relevance to Arab societies. Nakhle Wahbe and many others like Mohammed Boubakri and others have voiced critiques and called for a new conceptual approach to education research and for new research agendas. This is particularly crucial if the knowledge that informs educational policies and reforms is expected to reflect the plurality of societal, cultural, and socio-political experiences, tensions, and voices prevalent across the region. Such an endeavor requires a rethinking of the role played by research, and I think this is a very important point raised by Professor Sultana earlier in his kitab, and I concur with him on that point. Such an endeavor requires a rethinking of the role played by research and researchers, not only in terms of offering new conceptual tools and role models, but also in terms of building research approaches, which, in the words of Linda Herrera and Carlos Alberto Torres, consider educational research as part of a transformative social justice, powered by critical social theory and critical ethnography, which, they say, may offer a basis for hope. In a review of major work on globalization and education, Susan Robertson identifies three absences in our own knowledge of globalization and education that need to be addressed as part of this agenda if we are to develop ways of knowing that help us understand and act upon a particular historical conjuncture. First, she says, we need to understand, quote, the ways in which institutions concerned with education are assembled and reassembled over time, how these configurations of knowledge power produced through these institutions endorse particular kinds of subjectivities, and how these configurations of power translate into what she calls a functional and scalar division of the labor of education between regional, national, and local scales. Secondly, We need to know whose knowledge is being globalized. We talk a lot about the knowledge society, but whose knowledge is being globalized and whose knowledge is not being globalized? We need to know whose knowledge is being globalized and how the instrumentalization of knowledge, quote, in privileging some social entities and by disqualifying others, wastes experience and knowledge. It is crucial to examine, quote, how our own research and dissemination agendas might productively engage with alternative, other, or subaltern knowledges of globalization. Thirdly, Robertson emphasizes that we need to understand how a globalizing education sector alters the politics of representation and of political legitimation. This is a prerequisite, she says, if you are to imagine new modes of democratic participation through which citizens can represent their interests, lay their claims, and articulate viable and sustainable forms and notions of social justice and development. These three absences, identified by Robertson, challenge us to think, and I think this conference is a wonderful opportunity to engage in that reflection, to think about a critical framework which integrates the dimension of thinking what do we mean by the Mediterranean region, given these wider development agendas that I've been referring to. So here I would like to offer a complementary point regarding the first point raised by Professor Sultana about the Mediterranean is not just, or the Arab region or the Mediterranean, and I will not go into the intricacies of these two notions at this moment. It's not just an issue of subjective representation. It is also a challenge to articulate a viable political agenda for this region. It's very important to emphasize this. And in relation to that, education cannot be just limited to skills, to competencies, etc., because as I try to argue here, it would lead necessarily and inevitably to the reproduction of the global order of economic power. So the question is, how do we rethink, reclaim, reinvent research? And our role as researchers in relation to the communities we research to promote that political dimension of the Mediterranean. So these three absences identified by Robertson challenge us to think about a critical framework which integrates dimensions of the region, of power, of epistemology and identity prevalent across the region in ways which, in the words of Arjuna Appadurai, an anthropologist, deparochialize the idea of research. Professor Sultana has talked about dislocated provincialism. And I think that part here resonates with that point, deparochializing the idea of research and maximizing what Appadurai calls the capacity to aspire. So, in conclusion, what I've tried to do in this presentation is to call for a more engaged and more politically aware education research agenda with regard to the Mediterranean region and the Arab world. I've tried to show that the problematic is not just a problematic of methodology, but also a problematic of political practice, and that educational researchers in that regard have a crucial role to play in terms of imagining new and more appropriate methodologies that could reflect the vibrancy and the diversity of the voices and concerns of their communities wherever located. Addressing these absences would facilitate a long overdue conversation which, in the words of John Wilinski, would translate our fascination with knowing, not solely as a form of work, because this is what I believe at the end of the day this notion of the knowledge society is, not solely as a form of work, but as a desire and a right to know, and as a responsibility to realize a cosmopolitan understanding of universal rights and acting on that understanding to effect a greater sense of community. Thank you very much.
Okay, I just have two quick questions and then we go off for our coffee break. Lots of issues raised here about setting up an alternative research agenda for the region.
Thank you very much. I just want to put forward a very, very simple question. Don't you think that policymakers have a role to play to implement this great idea of interculturalism? Because sometimes policymakers are not helping at all.
Policymakers have not been?
Sometimes you get policymakers who are not putting forward all their efforts, you know, to implement this great idea about interculturalism and interdialogue.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think the question you're raising is very important because it calls us to rethink what we mean by policy making, and what do we mean by policymakers. And I think I should actually thank you for the opportunity to reflect on that, because what I was trying to refer to in the presentation is the fact that many times in this region, policy making has only little bearing and connection with the communities it serves, or it purports to serve. So I think that your question leads to a broader question. How can we also reclaim this model of policy making, which are more open on the local scene and engage these communities, not as part of externally imposed agendas, but as part of locally embedded politics, in a way. So the point that I was trying to make in that regard, and this is where I would like to pose that as a point for reflection in regard to your question, that I think that education researchers have a lot to play here in terms of creating these alternative discourses. In a previous piece I wrote, I described some of the research going on in the Arab region, but I would say, I think, building on what Professor Sultana has been describing, as the culture of the null hypothesis, which is the most frequent, for example, way of doing research in many Arab countries. There is a null hypothesis, and then I set up as a researcher to explore whether it is the case or not the case. What I've been trying to argue here is that we need to move from that null hypothesis and conceive of research as more engaged, co-constructive, participative, talking to the people one research. It is absolutely amazing when you go on many of the development work going out there in the Arab region, particularly in many countries from Syria to Jordan, or even in Saudi Arabia or Egypt. How few times researchers actually talk to the people. So what I'm trying to say here is that models of education research can inform or can lead to the articulation of more context-sensitive conceptions of policy making. And in that sense, I think rethinking methodologies that emphasize the participative, the co-constructed dimension of knowledge is one way to go about it.
This will be the last question.
Yeah, I very much appreciated both lectures this morning. But my comment to you, Andre, is the following. As you were talking and as Ronald was talking earlier, I was thinking about the issue of the Mediterranean. I mean, if you go back to Brodel's work and many other works that we're familiar with, in addition to other works by travelers and others in the Islamic and the Arab world, for example, you discover that there were historical patterns of interaction, trade routes and other forms of interaction around the Mediterranean that were very, very significant for centuries. At a different level, at a very basic human level, at the level of architecture, at the level of planning, at the level of basic life and existence. As I came yesterday, and Ronald picked me up from the airport and I brought me here, this is the first time I come to this island, and I felt at home. I mean, I felt like I was in a familiar place, having grown up around the Mediterranean. So, at a very basic human level, you feel that you are at home, at one level. And at the second level, I mean, I think one of the issues that we have to deal with is the issue of globalism. We mention globalism as a generic kind of general term, and we take it for granted, and we accept some of the definitions that are given to us. But there were patterns of globalism around the Mediterranean for centuries. And I think, you know, you may want to call it regionalism if you want, but I think that there were patterns, significant patterns along all kinds of levels. All it requires is just a little bit of historical curiosity, a little bit of a multidisciplinary approach to look at it from different angles. I don't think it should be that terribly difficult to produce a conceptualization which is extremely important at different levels of research, studies, interactions, and so on around the Mediterranean, and to do in the process to do a very important critique of this kind of bizarre literature dealing with globalism that is tied too much to neoliberal perspectives and free trade and all that stuff. Thank you.
I mean, I'll respond to that. Other questions?
No.
Okay, so just let me say something very important. I think it's a good opportunity to perhaps conclude on that point. When one thinks about the Mediterranean, when one thinks about the Arab region, whatever geographic or geopolitical reality, in a way, I mean, let's admit, all these constructions and configurations are arbitrary constructions. And I build here, or Bourdieu and others. They are cultural arbitraries in that sense. And I think taking that as a point of departure is a good exercise to build a sense of community. And in previous discussions I've had with several colleagues, including with Professor Sultan, we were reflecting a little bit on this notion of the Mediterranean. And I think more than a reality in that sense, that people try to say, oh, this is what it is, there is a human reality here, the human reality there, I think it's good to take it as a heuristic device to start to explore possible configurations of community within the broader context of the challenges of the day. So it is, rather than taking it as a point of departure, it's taking it as an imaginary horizon towards which one could strive to build something which is valuable surely for the people in this region, but which might be also valuable as a part of human experience for people in other places to consider. So in that sense, I think that education researchers have a big role to play to create that imaginary horizon. But in order to be able to engage that, I think one has also to deparochialize, as I was quoting Padurai, what research stands for, and understand research not as a cookbook you apply, but also as a kind of horizon which allows you a lot of latitude in terms of imagining what you want to do and what you want to struggle for, and mobilizing it in view of that vision. I agree with the point that you raised with regard to globalization, and it's a big debatable point, but I would like to say only something very brief here. The Mediterranean, in a sense, or the region we are talking about, of course has exhibited along its history all forms of interactions, cultural and other. But by no means one can say that all these forces represent something that is always coherent. In many ways, there are also a lot of contradictions and tensions and challenges in the way people have developed this sense of humanity and community. And I think that we should not shy away of also emphasizing these points of divergence, but also understand how one can transcend them into building that imaginary horizon. The point about globalization, of course, goes back to a very powerful, to a very big debate. But I think that it would be important also to understand globalization not as something abstract, but as something that one builds at the level of one how performs one's daily activities as a researcher, as an educator. In a way, I would like just to link that to the argument I was trying to do. When one talks about hegemonic forms of research, they don't exist in the abstract in that sense. They are enacted in the fact that we may go about, each one of us, thoughtlessly, just taking what we think is valid research and just putting it in our context. So how can we use that point to rethink the local in ways which open it up on its potentialities? Becomes an important exercise. Here as well, I think that educators had a lot to do, and researchers in the field of education in this region have a lot to do in terms of questioning these research methodologies, in terms of imagining them, in terms of opening them out on multiple realities.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, Professor Casamir.